Welcome everyone to the Top Producer Podcast. This is Paul Niefer, your host, and today we're going to have a conversation with Hallie Schaffner from, Northeast Arkansas. Would that be the best description of where you're at, Hallie?
Yes, in the heart of the Arkansas Delta.
Okay. And of course, we'll do a deeper dive into the farm operation. And I'm trying to think if I have had a conversation before on the podcast with a rice farmer. You may be the first rice farmer that I've had a conversation with. I'm not totally sure on that.
Well, so. I'm honored.
and you are, and of course, I'm going to butcher the title here. You know, Margie's going to get mad at me, but you are the, I'm going to say it's the top producer next gen, or what's the official title? So help me out there, because I'm going to butcher it.
It's the I think it's just the next gen ag next, award, the next okay, generation.
Okay, the top producer next gen. So I wasn't too far off, you know.
Yes.
And Margie, if you're listening, don't chew me out too badly. So, as I do with all these podcasts, I like to start with your background. So where you grew up, went to college, maybe you had a career before you came back to the farm, all those good things. So let's go over that.
Sure. So I grew up where I farm now. I'm the sixth generation of my family to farm in Northeast Arkansas. We have about a 2,000 acre operation here, just outside of Jonesboro. I grew up working alongside my parents. Both my mom and dad farmed, were involved in farming, and I went away to college in Nashville. So I went to Vanderbilt University.
Okay.
Later went to graduate school at the University of Arkansas in Little Rock, and really did not have plans to return to the farm. My parents were very adamant that I not stay on the farm. They said I needed to go and do something else for a while. So I did. And none of it was very exciting, honestly. I did some grant writing. I did some marketing. I worked in web design for a while, and I really did not like any of it. And so in 2016, my parents really wanted to step away from the operation, and they asked if I would be interested in coming back, because really there was no other option for them. It was, you know, it was either I come back or they just close it down eventually. And so I did, and found out that I loved it, and been doing that ever since. That was 2016.
Okay, so the operation in Jonesboro, again, I think you are my first rice farmer. It isn't just strictly rice that you grow. So what are the crops that you grow on your farm?
So my parents started a very special kind of farm. When I was a baby, they moved back to Arkansas from Texas after they got married and wanted to start a research farm. Hmm. So my dad's the farmer. My mom is a plant physiologist. She has her master's from UC Davis. And they started a research farm for contract research in rice, soybeans, corn, wheat. A lot of that was residue trials, testing new chemistries. And that was my mom's specialty. In the mid-2000s, when genetics kind of came the next big thing, we got into genetic work and seed production. So genetic equivalency trials, lots of seed increases. And that snowballed into seed increases and seed purity for both soybeans and rice. And that's what we do today. So about half of what we do is soybean increases for pre-commercial research varieties. That's about 250 varieties every year that we produce on our farm. And then we grow 20 different varieties of specialty rice for seed production as well. And that ranges from, we have jasmines and basmatis, we have reds and purples, we have sake and sushi rices. We like to grow all of the weird stuff. And that is still very, very niche market in the Mid-South, but we're hoping to grow that. So we do rotate some commercial soybeans and corn, and we also have a little bit of wheat as well. So we're 2,000 acres, which is a small farm relative to most of the farms in my area.
But again, with all the seed that you're doing, it's a lot more management intensive than probably even a larger farm would be, wouldn't it?
It is, and we manage the entire process. So we plant, harvest, we make sure that everything remains segregated, and we process the seed by cleaning it, packaging it, arranging for shipments. So we do the whole the whole thing.
Now, I know in some areas when you're dealing with seed, you know, they worry about cross-pollination and so on. Do you have to segregate, you know, one variety of rice has to be a certain distance away from another variety as far as your seed, or how does that process work?
We do. We have isolation just by distance, but we also do maturity isolation. So we'll plant one variety next to each other, and they both have different heading dates. So we make sure they're not pollinating at the same time.
Okay. Now, is it normally planted in the fall or the spring or both?
So we'll start planting rice here in about 2 weeks. Hopefully,
Okay.
fingers
Okay.
crossed, the weather works out.
So it's always a
And we'll
it's
harvest. Yes, it is a spring crop. We'll harvest it in September.
okay. Now I know, because I've visited some farms in the Delta, and you guys use quite a bit of water, or at times you use a lot of water for rice. What is the primary reason why you're flooding the rice field?
Yeah, so rice is our most water intensive crop for sure. I think I read that it takes about 370 gallons to produce 2.2 pounds of finished product. We keep rice under flood for two reasons. One, rice needs water, needs more water than most crops. But two, it's mostly a weed control issue. Rice doesn't have a lot of herbicides that are broad spectrum, the way Roundup is or Liberty. So in order to drown out the weeds, we keep a 3-inch flood in the field, surrounded by levees. That doesn't eliminate, of course, the aquatic weeds, so we have herbicides for that. But there have been a lot of pushes in the industry to save water by growing rice in different conditions. One way is alternative wetting and drying, which is essentially pumping water onto the field and not keeping it there. So letting it dry down through evaporation and soil penetration, and then pumping it back up as you need to. That saves on a lot of water, but it just makes your weed control more challenging. Row rice is the same kind of situation, you know, actually growing rice in furrow irrigated rows instead of levees. And we're trying all of those things. I mean, we're very motivated to save on water, as long as we don't compromise our yield or quality, with too much weed pressure.
Now, for your fields, are you planting those fields so you have basically fairly flat, or what is it? Just a teeny bit of slope so that the water will drain? Is that the type of fields that you guys have?
Yeah, there are two types of fields in Arkansas. You have zero grade, which are completely flat. Those are very ideal for the alternative wetting and drying I just mentioned. Because we're a little hillier than the zero grade areas of Arkansas, our slopes are 1 to 2%. So we do level as much as we can, but we still use some levees to cascade the water from the top to the bottom of the field. Obviously, that's kind of a field by field basis. We have some fields where the levees are really close together, which we don't like, but we deal with it.
Well, and you know, you mentioned that rice is water intensive, but really a lot of that water is either going back into the river or back into the ground, or it's evaporating. Eventually it'll fall as rain somewhere else. Am I oversimplifying that? I mean, it just seems like, I know the consumer out there automatically assumes that farmers are using a lot of water, and yes, they are, but they're not really consuming a lot of water. Ultimately, it's coming back into the system, isn't it? I mean, I know the rice is going to uptake some of it, but am I being too simplified there?
No, so we irrigate from a water table. We drill our wells down and irrigate from below ground. and our aquifer recharges with rain, and it's fed by two rivers. We're right in between two rivers. And that's really beneficial because it recharges from rainfall, both here and north, coming down the river. The issue is when the aquifer can't recharge via rainfall. And that's kind of what some people are seeing in South Arkansas, where their water tables are reducing and not recharging. I mean, that's going to be one of the bigger issues with climate change and drought-related issues. It's just recharging these aquifers. And us using less water, using less of the aquifer requires it to be recharged less often. So anything we can do to save water is always going to be good. Plus, it just saves us money if we don't have to pump as much water.
And you're probably going to make me jealous because actually I did another podcast, I think that just came out yesterday, and I was talking with a farmer in northwestern, or basically western Iowa, and his well I think is 150 feet deep, and I had to drill one in Missouri. I think it's either 12 or 1600 feet deep. I think it's 1200 feet deep, 1600 gallons. But you're going to tell me, I'm sure you're going to tell me your well doesn't go 1200 feet deep, aren't you?
No, definitely not. Definitely not. We're in the 100-foot range.
I knew you were
But
going to say that.
yeah, I mean, we are very lucky to be where we are. I mean, we're right on top of a lot of water, and I know a lot of places in the country can't say that.
Well, it's like the area where I grew up, just Walla Walla County, very interesting on the because the foothill it's bounded by the Columbia River on the west. It's bounded by the Snake River on the north, and then Columbia County to the east, and Oregon to the south, or the Blue Mountains to the south. So as you are along the Blue Mountains, you get about 30, 35, 40 inches of rain or more, but as far as the farming area. And then as you go up to the Snake River, it drops down to about 6 inches of rain. So you can tell that the yield differences between 150 bushel near the Blue Mountains is a typical in a good year or more, down to maybe 50 bushels per acre or 40 bushels per acre as you get close to the Snake River. So it just depends where you're at in the
Right.
country.
Yeah, it does. And of course, the varying weather patterns don't really help.
No. And whether we call it man-made climate change or not, we know that climate has changed, but I think what we have to realize too is throughout history, climate has changed. So climate never stays static. So, but we'll get off of that subject. That'll be a subject for another podcast. So, do your parents still help out in the farm, or is it just you, or do you have a couple hired people? I'm just curious how the management and the labor structure on the farm is.
It's just me now. My parents stepped away officially in 2019. And we are pretty labor intensive for being only 2,000 acres. There are 9 of us full
Okay.
time and 15 of us at the height of the season.
And so on your seed operation, about how much of your acres is dedicated to seed versus commercial?
Well, it varies year to year, just depending on what companies need. But usually we only have about 200 to 300 acres in commercial production. So about 1600 to 1700 acres a year is in seed production.
Okay, so that is that's so is the commercial just there for rotation purposes, or why do you even do any commercial?
Yeah, it's just for rotation. So for rice, if we're growing a seed lot of rice, we have to rotate that field out 2 years
Okay.
into soybeans or corn, depending on the field.
Okay.
So, and our soybeans, because they are different traits, we can't grow, say, an Xtend Flex variety behind an Enlist variety because we need to be able to chemically rogue out any volunteers to keep the seed pure. It's a challenging rotation.
I can believe it, especially with the fact that you got, like you say, what, about 20 varieties of rice, and then you have all the other varieties of soybeans. Now, is there a special harvester for either corn or soybeans when you're dealing with seed? Because I know I've in the Columbia Basin, I've ridden on a combine that was harvesting seed corn, and it's definitely not the same type combine that that you would use to harvest field corn. So I'm just curious what type of equipment, if there's any specialized equipment you have to use.
Not terribly specialized. We, as part of our rice seed production, we do have what we call head rows or panicle rows. Those are very short 6-foot rows that we plant from one single head of rice. And we do that so that we can plant thousands of those and evaluate each panicle for any off types that might be there. We want to make sure there aren't any off types in any of the varieties we maintain. And because those are such small areas, you know, maybe less than 0.05 acres, we have this small little research combine. It's a Kincaid, a Massey Ferguson. And that's what we use for our very small areas.
I was going to say, does that have like a little 4-foot wide header? I think I've seen those, or it's not very big, is it?
No, it's very small. My son calls it the baby combine. If you cut corn, you can cut corn with it. It's got a corn header and it's four rows. So that's about how big it is. Okay. It's about 10 feet.
Okay.
The larger varieties or the larger lines that we grow, if we're growing, say, half an acre of a breeder lot, we'll cut it with, we have a 1460 case that we bought out of the Midwest, very old combine. And we have four of those because they are just perfectly sized for what we do. And then we modify them. We put air on them so that when we clean them out between each variety, it's easier, makes it faster. Well, and then of course we have our big combines for our big lots.
Yeah. I grew up, I operated a International 453 for probably, I guess I was driving for my dad 6 years or so before I finally, my dad finally retired. But if he had kept farming, we would have had a 1470, you know, that was the next model. And then, cause for the hillside, and then the 1670 and then the 2388 and so on. But, and the nice thing about those 1670s or 1470s, they can go anywhere on a steep hill. I mean, it can be 45, 50, 60 degree slope, and they'll just climb right up the hill or go on the hillside. Whereas the newer models, they don't quite operate as well on the hillsides.
That I did not know, but then we don't have that problem here.
your steep ground is 2% slope. We call that flat out in our area. So, I think the steepest ground I've ever been on is probably 60% slope, but you know, only for maybe half an acre, an acre or something like that. So it's not too bad. But so now when you're harvesting using those, are all four operating at the same time, or is it maybe two are operating and two are in the shop? Or I'm just curious, because those are old, you know, probably the newest one's what, 35 years old, probably? Somewhere in there?
Yes. Maybe yes. 40, so we run five combines at a time. And usually three are in the field while two are being cleaned.
Okay.
So we'll go in and we'll cut half an acre or an acre lot, clean it in the field, and go to the next one. We have to make sure the combines are completely clean so we have no contamination of the next variety.
Right. So for those people
It means last year we cleaned our combines over 300 times during the harvest season.
I was going to say, for those operators out there that have, you know, maybe 10,000 acres and they never have to clean their combine, just think if you had to clean your combine 300 times during harvest, you know, so that is definitely a lot more management. Now, I'm assuming then that you have storage facilities at your warehouse for all the different varieties. You have to keep them segregated in separate bins, or let's go through that process. So you harvested the grain, you bring into the warehouse. Explain sort of from coming out of the field what your process is to finally get it out the door to your customer.
So for our larger lots, we have small bins. We have some bins that are 1,000 bushels and some that are 5,000 bushels. And those are used for our larger lots. Anything smaller than, say, 500 bushels, we can actually bag off into big bulk bags, put them on pallets and store them in our warehouses. We have two large warehouses here that we use for storage. One is climate controlled, so that we can store our rice. We can maintain the germination on it. The germination is very important. Obviously, we don't need that to fall out during the winter. So we try to maintain temperature control on those. We make sure that everything is labeled. We have standard operating procedures for cleaning of every piece of equipment that hauls grain. And what's most important for us, of course, is identity preservation, and that the product we bring out of the field is quality. So we have our own grain grading procedures. And then, of course, over the winter, we'll start cleaning it with our cleaning equipment, packaging it up to ship out. And everything is grown under contract. We aren't selling it to farmers, that we don't know. This is all people coming to us and saying, we want you to produce 100,000 pounds of X specialty variety for the next year.
Okay. And so you're cleaning the combine, but then you also have to clean the grain cart or the truck or whatever is bringing that product from the field to the warehouse. How do you do that process?
Right. It's all compressed air and manual labor.
Okay. So somebody gets in there with a...
We clean the combine. Yeah. I have climbed into many seed carts with a leaf blower.
Okay. And you're able to get every single little particle of rice out. So that's pretty impressive. So, Hallie, we're going to go ahead and take a break for a sponsor message, and we'll come back and discuss a few other things.
How many years away is the long run for a farmer? 5 years? 10 years? Top producers like Hans Reinschi, a Blue Diamond farming company in Jessup, Iowa, know RoboAgri Finance shares his enduring vision for the future.
Whether it's building our grain site or if it's purchasing the next field, we're able to turn to Rabo as a trusted partner to help us get financing to make those generational decisions.
With unmatched financial capacity, local relationship managers, and a global network of sector experts to offer market guidance, RoboAgri Finance provides enterprising farmers with a personalized approach to lending and financial services. Growing a better world together. RoboAgri Finance.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Top Producer Podcast. This is Paul Niefer, your host, and we're going to rejoin our conversation with Hallie Schaffner from Northeastern Arkansas. So, Hallie, your parents officially sort of retired, or I'm sure they might come out and help once in a while, but they retired a few years ago. And it sounds like you have some kids. Is the long-term plan to have your kids go into the operation, or is it sort of like your parents, you're going to tell your kids, hey, you got to go do something else and then maybe come back, or have you even gotten that far yet?
Well, my son is 5. I went to the Top Producer Summit, I guess that was 3 weeks ago, maybe. And they had a bunch of sessions on succession planning. And I thought, I'm not quite there yet. And I really think that I want for him what my parents did for me, which is just go out and see the world, do a few things first. And then if you decide this is what you want, then we'll support you 100%.
Yeah. I think certainly when I wanted to go back to the farm, but I was in the mid 80s or early 80s, well, sort of the mid 80s. And my dad's going like, you would be smarter to be a CPA. He actually wanted me to be a CPA. He thought that was better than than being a farmer. And you know, he was older. He only had an eighth grade education. He was born in 1912, grew up, you know, really started the Depression, homesteaded in a couple areas. So for him, you know, being a CPA just sounded a whole lot better than farmer. But I've sort of reverted back now. I have three farms. I got a farm in Missouri, Iowa, and Washington State. So I'm back to being a farmer, I guess. So, but I think right now, you know, a five-year-old, some five-year-olds know what they want to do. Other five-year-olds, you know, they'll change their mind about 72 times. So.
Right. Well, I don't think he loves school at this point. So he did offer to quit school and come work for the farm, which I told him was absolutely not an option. I went out and I saw the world for about, you know, about 10 years, essentially. My parents were very supportive. My grandmother was also very supportive. I went and lived in India, in Spain. I've lived in Peru. I went out to the West Coast and lived in Seattle for a while, got a couple degrees and really got to enjoy life, but I also gained a lot of perspective, yeah. I think, than if I had just stayed home. I've met lots of different people and experienced lots of different ways of life. And I'm very grateful for that. I think it really helps, and bring a fresh perspective to the farm.
For those listeners on the podcast, of those countries that you visited or lived in, you know, which country would you suggest somebody that wants to travel around the world, which countries do you think would be the most interesting for them?
Oh, gosh, all of those are amazing. So I lived in Spain for the longest time, and I think that was probably my favorite. Because it's just got so much variety within the country. Although you can say the same thing about Peru. So Peru also has a lot of variety in the country. But Spain has a lot of very wonderful food, wonderful wine. You really can't beat that at all.
Well, I sort of agree. My son lived in Spain for about on and off about 2 years. And then he's lived in Thailand. He's lived in Turkey. He's our world traveler. So although he's home visiting right now, he's getting ready to fly out tomorrow. And actually my wife and my son, probably my son was 21 and my wife, so this would be about 8-9 years ago. They actually backpacked through Spain for a whole month and they only had a backpack. So, I was pretty impressed. And they're both geographically challenged. So I was actually very impressed that they made it home. So, that's a story for another day. So, you know, we're getting close to the end of the podcast. I always like to end with about four questions. First is, who was your mentor in this process? And I have a feeling I can guess who it might be, but who was your mentor?
Yeah, so it's my mom. My mom is one of the smartest people I've ever met. And she is such a role model. What's funny is she doesn't think she's a role model because she never had any, you know, like overt conversations with me about what it meant to be a good person or even a strong woman. But because she was a good person and a strong woman and a great farmer, that's what I saw and that's what I knew I could be. So. And I still get to hang out with her all the time, even though she doesn't have any involvement in the farm. I still go to her for advice, or just to rant and rave sometimes about whether it's market volatility or weather or whatever.
Yeah. And, do you have time for any hobbies?
As a farmer, I don't have a lot of time. I feel like farming is both a profession and a hobby. I love to hang out with my son. You know, at five, he's developed such a wonderful little personality. Yeah. And I love to bring him to the farm. It's a lot of fun. He and I will ride around together like I used to do with my dad.
Yeah, no, I have a almost 6-year-old granddaughter and almost a 4-year-old grandson. And I just love that period. You can just see them developing and getting their personality and, you know, my 6-year-old granddaughter, she's the driven alpha female, you know, the firstborn, and the almost 4-year-old grandson, we call him Bam Bam because he's always bam bamming into somebody or something. And then the 1-year-old grandson, he's just learning by watching the other two what not to do, I think. So we'll see how that goes. But is there anything that keeps you up at night?
Yeah. The same thing that keeps all farmers up at night, I guess, is money.
and weather.
And weather. The things you can't control, of course. You know, I worry about the agricultural industry in the South specifically, because I feel like we are very boxed into just 4 crops, essentially. You know, we don't have many options. We don't have a lot of diversification here in terms of what we can grow and what kind of infrastructure can support specialty crops. You know, I grow specialty rice, which is a version of a commodity. It's sort of like decommodifying the commodity, adding value to it. But farmers in the South don't have a lot of that. And because of that, we do not have any control over how much money we make. And we're at the mercy of the market, as well as the weather, as well as input costs. And I think that's very dangerous. I think that we're going to have to start rethinking our food economy, our food systems in the South, for diversification.
Well, and you know, with the fact that you do have, I'm going to say, favorable weather at times, you know, you're able to get into the field longer, you have a longer growing season, it does make sense that you should be able to grow different crops. But like you say, you've sort of been boxed into growing those major 3 or 4 major crops. Really, your major crops are going to be what? Rice, cotton, soybeans, and depending where you're at, corn and wheat. Do I have that right?
Yeah. Yep. That's right.
Okay. Okay. Well, I'm not totally clueless. So, unless you talk to my sons, and then, you know, of course, dad is clueless. Yeah. So at that point, but,
yeah.
And then finally, what's your definition of success in farming?
Gosh, sometimes I think that's a moving target. So sometimes I wake up and I think success is just being able to do this another year. I think it kind of goes back to what keeps me up at night. I think success for me personally, and I would hope this would mean success for other farmers, is the ability to find opportunities outside of the existing commodity structure. The specialty rice is an important piece of that, but we're actually going to grow a little bit of cowpeas this year, which is black-eyed peas. There used to be a market for black-eyed peas in the South, and there is not anymore because we do not have the processors. Being able to diversify out of a commodity and into something added value, like cowpeas, being able to rotate my specialty rice with something else that's specialty, for me, that is success, because that in the end is going to give me more control.
Yeah.
And more money.
Yeah, totally agree. Totally agree. Well, Hallie, is there anything else that you'd like to add before we sign off?
No, I was so honored to be selected for the award. The Producers Summit, the Top Producers Summit, was so much fun. I was treated so well by the staff. So I'm very grateful to them, and just really honored to be included in the cohort.
Well, you're definitely a deserving winner of the award. So again, this is the Top Producer Podcast, and this is Paul Neefe, your host, signing off.